I hear feedback. Is it up? It's in my head. My name's DeAndre, and I'm an alcoholic. Whoa. Uh-oh, now all of my enemies are showing up now that I can't get off the podium. How's it going? Oh, God. It's good to be home.
Electrify the stage.
We all know who that was. Thank you, Nicholas. Grateful to be sober. Good to be home. This is my home group. Home. Home is where the heart is. Phil, wow, look at all the people coming in. There's Frank, my God. Yep. Thought we got rid of these people. Good to be sober. I want to thank my sponsee family for driving all the way out here. It's a long haul for a lot of my friends to come out. I told them that I got sober here, so they thought they had to come and help support me. Because this is a place where a lot of my wreckage took place in early sobriety, not necessarily drinking. My sobriety date is May the 29th, 1991, and my cue card is right there, that plaque up on the wall. It's been there for quite a while, and it's good to be sober. Wow, Jesus Christ. I can't leave now, man. I was thinking about drinking tonight. Shit. Good to be sober. I'm recovering from surgery. I had surgery a week ago today on my throat and adenoids. They took my adenoids out. They were going to take my tonsils, but I begged him to really work around that, and he did. But it took about an hour for them to get the breathing tube down my throat, so it's caused a lot of discomfort and a lot of pain. And I'm still kicking. I'm still here, still alive, and really happy, man. To start off, I got sober at Warm Springs, but before then, I drank in a little town right outside of this one called Watts. And I drank, and I got loaded, and I ran, and I loved it. And it was the best time of my life, man, until this place, which you weirdos. But I loved living that sort of life of the sick and aimless, you know, and just moving and a-grooving and making sure that not only am I running from this disease, but I'm running from the wreckage as well, you know, because I know by the time it was almost ready for me to be at Warm Springs, I knew that there was some shit collapsing. Big Book says that, you know, we go on these senseless sprees and, you know, the structure is brought down after we have accomplished some things or basically stayed sober for a little while or managed our drinking or whatever. And that's what kind of alcoholic I am. I'm one of those alcoholics that you can't trust just because it looks good and feels better for you to be around me. This disease is on the inside. And on the outside, I mean, it's kind of like dressing up a trash can. You know, I know how to put on this image. Big Book says that I know how to live this double life. And that's what I was doing while I was out there, is putting out this image in regards to my drinking that I didn't want to stop. You know, and I had no idea that it wasn't like some sort of a prideful thing or some sort of fucking, you know, like power. It was the obsession to drink. And my obsession to drink, it gets me to a point where I arrange everything around alcohol. Everything. Including a long stretch of sobriety without the steps, but I'll get to that later. And part of my insanity in dealing with this obsession to drink is beyond my control. I can't control it. People say that certain things happen and then they went and got drunk. Well, see, I'm an alcoholic. I wake up drunk. See? I'm sleeping. All of a sudden, I wake up and fuck, I'm loaded. You know, and it's almost like a freebie. I don't even remember how I got it done, you know? And this insanity just pursued me and followed me wherever I went because, and the reason why I term it like that is I thought that it was these outside situations, or how you were telling me I should feel, Or like in school when they say, you have an attitude problem, you know. My response is, yeah, that's because you don't agree with me. If you agreed with me, you would see that my attitude is fine. And that kind of screwy thinking, the Big Book calls it, you know, we have these, I have this idea that's grounded in reality, and right next to it is the insanity and the game that I play to get to that front drink. So that's why you can't really go by the outsides with this guy. You know, and part of the thing that took place before I got into rehab was I had started not being able to really stay with the people who drank almost as much as I did. They had started rejecting me also. Because I wound up living on 5th and San Julian. I know how some people in AA say that Skid Row is in your mind. I'm telling you that Skid Row feels really different when it's on your ass. And that's where I wound up. And I love Skid Row, man. Being downtown, I remember the first night that I went down there, my mother had kicked me out of the house. And, you know, a lot of people, when they get thrown out of the house, they're devastated. And it's like, oh, fuck, I can't live there anymore. And my natural thought when my mother kicked me out was, right on! I'm going to get loaded as hell! Yeah! You know, yippee! You know, like those sporting events. I'm going to Disneyland. You know what I'm just fucking... And I went downtown. Somebody had told me about downtown. A friend of mine had said that it was sort of like, you know... like in the little cartoon Pinocchio, where you can just go downtown and everybody, and nobody's really responsible for anything, especially reality. And you can drink and get loaded and be drunk forever. And I was attracted to that. I like that. I like the way that sounds. Plus, I was wearing this camouflage hat that sort of resembled some of the Disney characters, like a Peter Pan hat. And I had put buttons around this hat. And I was in my own world when it came to the first drink, you know. And I went down there, and I got on that bus, and I rode that bus down there. And I got off the back of that bus, man. And I felt that like that white lady in that movie, The Sound of Music, where she's spinning around on the hill, the hills. I just felt like I was at home. And I loved downtown. And on certain days, if it gets a little rough for me, I envision being down there still, not putting up with you or me, you know, real alcoholic. And after living down there for about 2 years, without a pot to piss in or a window to throw it out of, I was pretty much a dead man talking. And I had done that to myself, and I knew it. And it wasn't because people were forcing me to get drunk. It was because I always made drinking being about making it, you know. As long as I could get loaded, I'm making it. And most people in my life would be telling me, man, if you would stop getting loaded, you'd make it. And I'm an alcoholic. I think backwards, you know. I don't think right when it comes to alcohol without some sort of a psychic change. And what happened was I wound up getting thrown out of that community. It's really hard to get thrown out of Watts. I mean, if somebody throws your ass out of Watts, you got some problems. And I got thrown out of there, and I was at a place where I realized that not only was my drinking catching up with me, but my insides had started matching my outsides. And that's when I accepted that I was really in some serious trouble. That no longer could I show up at your party and you would drop me off on an alley corner, and I'd say, well, I live right there, and you'd drive off, and I'd go sleep on the street. You know, all of that stuff was catching up with me because people were starting to ask me questions, you know. Like, why, what is that odor? You know, because so people would just be looking around, and I'd be like, well, I don't know shit. I don't, you know, your mama, you know. Because I don't want to deal with the reality of the first drink, man. And that first drink is so powerful, you know, because it's like the relapse has happened long before I take it. You know, there's a term that I've been hearing in the last several years now that Shalabi and I talk about over the phone is fake it till you make it. And the reason why that phrase rubs me the wrong way, because first of all, it's not in the big book. Nowhere in that big book does it say, you know what, go ahead and fake it till you make it. You know, it tells me that I need some rigorous honesty. And I don't know how to do that without some help. I'm inconstitutionally incapable of being honest about the first drink. And so basically what happens is my inside starts matching my outsides, and all of a sudden I start realizing that people are finding out. People around me. My mother is warning people now that I'm in the area. She's telling people. I don't know where he's on his way, but he just left from over here. Keep an eye on him. You know, and basically what happened is I wound up getting beat up by two of some very close dear friends of mine. They beat my ass out, and they sent me to the hospital. And in that hospital, they gave me pain medication. And I'm a real alcoholic. I'm not someone who can take a certain drug, change the name of what I really am, and still try to keep the sham up. I don't know how to do that. And I abuse that pain medication like an alcoholic untreated will do, no matter what you call them. And I wound up wandering over to my aunt's house, and she had told me that she did not want me to live in the house anymore, that I could sleep on the floor in the garage, but that I was not allowed in the home anymore. And some of it had to do with that odor, probably, but a lot of it had to do with my behavior. And I wound up sleeping on that garage floor. And one morning she told me to go down to Big General Hospital and go to the little social services area department and see if those people could help you. And I went ahead and got on the bus, and I went down there to the hospital. She had given me the money, and I didn't spend it on a 40-ouncer, you know. And I went to Big General Hospital, and there was this little white lady sitting in this little, like, little, all I can envision is seeing her in, like, this little tent-like office booth thing. And she said, "We don't have anything here for you, but you need to go down the street to this little place, a little referral agency place for rehabs," and the place was called El Centro. And there I met a man named Ronnie Macias. And Ronnie Macias told me the most profound thing that I had ever heard in my life. He told me that I was 24 years old, I was already living on Skid Row, and I wasn't going to make it. And for some reason, I believed him. I don't know why, and I don't really care. And he walked out of the little cubicle thing to go get these bus tickets, which I now know now. And when he walked out, I got on my knees and I asked God to help me, is all I said. And when he came back, I stood up because I didn't want him to see me, you know. I mean, by all means, I got to still look good and feel better, you know. And he wound up putting me in a hotel room for 7 days. Boy, the pitch is going pretty well, but I keep thinking about this fly strip behind me, and it's driving me crazy. I'm really alcoholic here. Look, I know. It's just, I don't know what's. And I had to get that out. You know, would somebody please answer their phone? Whose phone is that? In the name of. I remember the first time I saw a homeless person with a cell phone, I was furious. Motherfucker got a cell phone. Homeless.
9 years on a bike.
Exactly. So what happens is I go to the hotel, I live there for 7 days, and I'm catching the bus back and forth from the hotel to Ronnie's office. And unbeknownst to me, I find out later, he's trying to find a rehab to put me in. Not once did he say, go to AA. That's how come I know we're lacking in 12-step work around these rooms. They don't even call us half the time. They call the rehabs now. And that's what he was doing. And I remember on the last day, I know this is starting to sound a little like Christianity, but bear with me. On the seventh day I was there. On the seventh day I was there, this little Jewish guy was in the hotel too, and he went and got 2 40-ouncers. And he and I drank those two beers and talked about the conflict in the Middle East until 4 a.m. And then I caught the bus back down to Ronnie's, and he told me to call Warm Springs Rehabilitation Center. And he said, go down to the Volunteers of a building and wait in Volunteers of America building on 5th and Spring, near 5th and San Julian. And I knew where that was because I had been living down there before the hotel. And I went on down there. And I don't know why I did that. And I don't care. And I went in there and I called a lady called Yolanda, who still works at Warm Springs. And every time I call her, she knows exactly who I am before I identify. She recognizes my voice for the past 16 years. And I talked to her and she said, how long have you been sober? And I said, well, I should have around 7 days, but I really don't, kind of, almost. And she said, well, you have to be sober when you come to Warm Springs. And I had saw, before I went into the building, I had saw a little piece of a roach on the ground. And I know we're in an A meeting, that the roach is a little part of a marijuana joint. And I picked that up and I smoked it. And then I went in and made the phone call to start my recovery, you know. And she told me that I should get on the van anyway. And that was on May the 28th of 1991. So I got on that van and I've been sober ever since. So I'm probably not going to spend a lot of time talking about drinking from here on out. And I got on that van and we went up that little road. And those of you who've gone to Warm Springs, you know that that road is like the road to Jericho, you know. So Jesus put his parish, you know, it's hard to get in there, you know. And on that van ride, I was with like 2 or 3 other guys that had been picked up from downtown. And everybody was talking about how many times they had gone to rehab. How many times they had been to these meetings. Somebody was saying something on the van about, yeah, I heard they got a lot of meetings up there. And I was thinking to myself, meetings about what? Meetings about these 3 warrants that I got for my fucking arrest, you know, because there was a county emblem on the van, and I noticed that. It's going to look like a sheriff car without the points on it, you know. And I was listening to these dudes. They were all in there like exchanging stories about the last time they tried to get, be, and stay sober. And I don't know, the van ride just seemed to be dominated with that. And I remember getting off that van and this little Mexican guy came over and he met me in General Services. That's the building where you go in and check in and they kind of just see where you're at and what you got. And I didn't have any underwear on. I had 1 pair of pants. And the lady behind the counter, Eileen, she died about 10 years ago. She said, do you have any underwear? And I looked at her with the dignity of a homeless person with no drawers on. You know. And I thought to myself, who is this lady? Because I'm in recovery now, right? See? I have not gotten loaded since that roach. And I've admitted now that, you know, maybe these people could probably help me as long as they don't lock me up for these 3 warrants. So I'm automatically in General Services, like, you know, that the conjuring up how my mind is going to fit around this first drink again. That's where I'm automatically going as an alcoholic when I show up without recovery, you know. And I'm standing there looking at her as if I really do have underwear on, and I'm being insulted by this woman, you know, wanting to know about my drawers and stuff. And I said, no, I don't. And I don't know why I did that. And I don't care. And a little guy is standing behind me, tripping off of me, and he said, man, just come on. Because I could tell that he knew that I was embarrassed. And he took me over to C dorm. And in that dorm, I got put in the overflow bed, C38. And I toughed it out. I detoxed. I was throwing up. I was using the restroom a lot. And I couldn't leave to go and get food from the cafeteria. So it was against the rules to have food in the dorm. And that guy snuck the food over to me. And I tried to eat what I could. And then 2 days after that, they put me in C4. And I remember the night that they put me in C4, I had some sort of a vision or some sort of an experience that I don't really share about that much as I share. And I woke up involved, you know. And that scares me sometimes to think about that, because it seemed as though I didn't have any control over that either. And the next thing you know, man, I just started running around that place like I needed to be there. And I remember being voted in as the secretary of one of these meetings. And I remember being voted in as the chairman of the entire fellowship. Now, one thing about being the AA steering committee chairman at Warm Springs is you don't have to take the steps, you know. And I remember being in charge of all these meetings and going around. And I took the role of AA steering committee chairman to another level, you know, because I started sitting in on all the AA meetings on the Hill and monitoring the meetings and making sure that they were doing AA the right way, you know. And I remember sitting in one of the Spanish-speaking meetings, making sure that even the Hispanic people in the community there were doing AA right. Problem is, I don't speak Spanish, so. But I kind of guessed it, you know. And after leaving there, there was a guy that worked there. His picture's about two plaques over from me with his baby. He has since died, Kenny Washington. Was a counselor at Warm Springs, and he was talking to me about this sober living home here in Lancaster. And while I was at Warm Springs, I was also in charge of theater therapy, which is a little theater arts program kind of thing, kind of like, you know, the Little Rascals on Crack, something like that. And I remember, you know, my brother came up and met Kenny and gave Kenny money so I could go and live at the sober living home. And I moved to Lancaster, you know. I just came here. I didn't go back to L.A. because I didn't think that there was anything there that could really help me. The only thing I knew that was in L.A. is the records that I had left there. And I didn't want to go back. And I came here to this community here, Lancaster. The open door, when I got sober, used to be about five doors down on the corner. And those people changed my life forever. Met a man named Dennis Lee at that first noon meeting that I had gone to the morning I got out of Warm Springs. I was talking in the meeting about how I wanted to get drunk. It was a month before my AA sobriety birthday. I had lived at Warm Springs for 11 months. It's a 90-day program. I mean, if you're going to hide from the first drink, you know. met him at that noon meeting. Something about what he was sharing in the meeting, he had made mention of how dirty the floor was. And he said, this floor is really dirty, but we really got a clean program here. And I went up to him after the meeting and asked him to be my sponsor. And the reason why I asked him to sponsor me is because from what I had been hearing around the meetings, you needed a sponsor in order to, I guess, seem as though that you weren't going to come back to rehab again, like all the other people I was hearing up there. And I started talking to him, and I was telling him that I had already worked the first three steps in rehabilitation. I had completed my step packet that they had given me. And he told me, that's wonderful. You know, he told me that's really good that you know about steps 1, 2, and 3, but I want you to learn from me what I know about steps 1, 2, and 3, because we need to get you started on your inventory. And I kind of looked at him, you know, in a very disturbed manner, because I had no intentions on taking your steps. You know, I had seen the steps in Warm Springs, I had read them on the wall, and I kind of figured they were like word problems. You read one and kind of figure out what sort of answer you want for yourself and then go to the next one. And he didn't allow that. And I'm just so grateful I met Dennis Lee before a lot of you guys got a chance to tell me about it, you know. Because I don't think I would have cooperated. At any rate, you know, he would spend a lot of time with this alcoholic. In the middle of work, home, and play, Dennis Lee made time for DeAndre. You know, and I remember complaining to a couple of my friends who are no longer sober. Most of the people that openly allow me to complain about AA are no longer here. They're gone. And I would tell them, why is he picking me up and the meeting is right around the corner? I don't need a ride to a meeting that is a block and a half away from the sober living home that I live in. And I tell the story like it was a little Disneyland ride. He would pull up in the little red Volvo. I'd get into the little ride. He'd take me to the meeting early so we could sit and wait for it to start together. And all of my close friends would be walking by, looking at me as if I was sort of trapped somewhere. And then once the meeting would start, we would come into the meeting. And then after the meeting, he would go out to the little red Volvo, and I would get inside the little red Volvo. And then we'd go right around the block, and he'd drop me off at the sober living home. And that went on for at least a year and a half. You know, and... And I just got taken through the steps. He would give me these little writing assignments based on the material that we were covering in the book, and he would tell me what to do. Now, I know that people in AA in this very meeting are against that. They don't feel comfortable being told what to do. And all I'm here to share is, in the bottom of all of that craziness is... You know, that's the main problem that I have as a real alcoholic for me, is I don't know how to take direction on my own away from that first drink. You know, I don't know how to stay away from the front drink on my own will. You know, and I just did what he told me to do repeatedly, you know. And I remember coming to him with all these different complaints about what my dry-ass friends would be agreeing with me on behind his back. You know. And he would just tell me little key, little caveats to keep me focused on what AA was about. And I'm just sharing my own experience. Now, I know that everybody doesn't have the same experience that I have with Dennis Lee, and I don't care. And I remember just following him in the meeting and going to the meeting, and then we would go over to his house, you know. And I don't understand why we have to go over to his house. But since when nobody else asked me to go to their house, I went to his. And we would go and he would read. He would want to read the book again. We would read it at the club and then we would read it at his house. And reading this book seemed to stimulate this fucker. I was annoyed by this piece of literature that was written in 1938 and published in 1939. I think that there are run-on sentences in this book. I believe that the structure of the writing is deplorable. I don't like the transitions from one paragraph to the next. And what the fuck is a m'lady here? These are the questions that I had about the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So in spite of my, you know, genius of being able to examine the book, he suggested a dictionary. And we would look words up, and then he took me one time, I had some voc rehabilitation going on, and he took me to Radio Shack to buy this little Franklin speller, which is a faster dictionary than the one that we were using. And I said, yeah, this is really neat. He said, type in the word insanity. Because like, I'm ready to look up some, like, you know, supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, you know. I want to look up some words. And he said, type in insanity. And I'll never forget this. It said the slanted perception of reality. And I remember you kept repeating that all the way back to the meeting. A slanted perception of reality. Wow. You know, just like a broken record, you know. And boy, I'll tell you, after that experience, I got a job. Finally started working. And something spiritual about having a job. And I do not understand that at all still today, but I cooperate. I've been employable ever since. But we went down to the place where I first started working, and he loaned me my first tie, and he took me to the job interview, and they hired me that day. And I worked at that place for 6 years, and we didn't spend a whole lot of time talking about drinking all the goddamn time. You know, rarely did we talk about drinking together. We spent most of our time talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. And most of my friends who I hung out with, I could go through their names, but I don't want to do that. But most of those people would be telling me, you know, he's boring. You know, why are you constantly with this man? And then I think he and Ike would work in shifts. The first man that he wrote, read his inventory to, one of the founders of this group. He would spend a lot of time with me too. We would go eat a lot together. And it just seemed like one would be there and then all of a sudden the next one would be there. And it was almost like they had a signal. You know. And I remember just, you know, being taken to that job and getting that job and working there for 6 years and just being involved in this group. You know, an open door for me is more than a place where you just come and talk, take turns talking. Some sort of spiritual intervention took place for me here, not just as in regards to sobriety, but sociologically. I didn't really know how to make that transition from not taking that front drink to really being honest about how I think. You know, I would, before AA, stay sober and hate it. You know, and just resent the thought of not being able to get loaded. But for some reason, hanging out with these people and being involved with these functions and yelling at Doug and Nancy at the business meeting and really just making sure that whatever the hell was going on around here, I was going to be sober and a part of it. Because I knew they didn't really let drunk people do a whole lot here. They allowed the drunk people to come here. They even treated the drunk people nice. But drunk people never really got a chance to argue fact about this fucking shit. And I was not going to get caught drunk around here proving that I didn't know shit about AA. So So God just used my ego and my character defects to help me get rid of them, I guess. I don't know. But I got involved, man, and I became the whatever if they needed it. If they needed somebody to run the Christmas party, I did it. If they needed somebody to get the list for the sign, this is before Doug took over. But I just did it, you know. And I guess what I'm trying to share in a general way is most of the time when I talk to people who are on their way out of here or don't plan on staying here, it is truly because they are not connected to here, to AA. And a lot of people are experiencing jack-in-the-box sobriety. They pull up to the window, they get whatever they need, and they drive off and leave us here with the new people. And from afar, they criticize what we're doing with these new people, as they are not here to help us. See that a lot. And one of the things I know about Dennis Lee, in spite of all of the defects and the shit that I didn't like, is he was always available when it came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember just being involved to the point where I didn't want to leave anymore. And I pray to God that I'm still there tonight. You know, it's been a long haul since then. I moved from here about 4 years ago. My first move was to Simi Valley. And Simi Valley is a little weird for a guy like me. Living in Simi Valley, to me, was really bizarre. They pull you over, like when you first get off the first off ramp, you get pulled over there and everybody checks you out. You drive about four more blocks and then homeboy has been radioed or something. They pull you over again. Maybe they missed something. And that went on for about half a year and I couldn't stand it. So I moved now and I live in Glendale, California. I've been in Glendale now and I love Glendale. It's a small little community where several years ago I probably wouldn't have been able to live, according to Dennis Lee this morning on the phone. And it was a beautiful transition for me because not only did I leave the school district I was working with, but I later got hooked up with this private company that pretty much does the same work that I was doing there. And I've been there going on 5 years now, you know, with this company. And I got an email from my program manager this week telling me to stay away and get better so we can have you back here. You know, and this is the kind of love and this is the kind of acceptance and this is the kind of transition that can happen for you, newcomer. You know, I found myself accepting the things that I couldn't change about him and this group and being willing to stay in the loop of Alcoholics Anonymous regardless. Because the fourth step puts me in AA, and the tenth step keeps me in AA. It helps me survive the fellowship, you know. And I deal with my life in a way in which I could never do before, you know. And I get the support of the people who are following along. Not the people that are stuck and trying to figure out who's right or wrong. But I get the support and the help from the people that are following along, that are not straying away. One of the girls that I sponsor talks about the penguins and the march of the penguins. And the penguins on the outside of the herd freeze to death because they don't get in there in the middle. And it's hard to fall off something if you're in it. So I don't spend a whole lot of time trying to get away from AA and get away from these people because I got my own agenda up here because my front drink experience is permanent, real, and it'll always happen. The only thing that keeps me away from there now is the grace of God. And I believe that that's where AA is, in His grace, as crazy as we are. And that's one of the reasons why I just stick with it, man. There's a lot of days that it gets a little salty around here. It doesn't feel good. If you're whining about being sober for 60 to 90 days, try doing it for 10 or 11 or 12 or 20 years, Baba. We all kind of get roughed up by reality. But nevertheless, there's some tools here that he taught me that is allowing me to stay put in Alcoholics Anonymous, no matter what's going on, especially up here. And you guys, to me, are an example of what the hell I can be. I can be connected to a group of people who have a singleness of purpose today. You know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not here to debate a goddamn thing with anybody. If you don't like what we have, and you're not willing to go through any length to get it, then you are going to take certain steps. So I'm not begging anybody that has already started. My big book says, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Once you've started, the begging stops, partner. You know, and I got to be like that because I've been sober since my first meeting so far. So my attitude has to be a little bit more assertive. I don't believe that I can leave here and come back. And I don't think it's because of some weird-ass trip that I'm on. I believe it's based on the fact that I've been restored to sanity in regards to that front drink, man. And I'm trying to do whatever the hell I can to stay the hell away from it. The first drink, not the third 40-ounce or the fourth burglary or the fifth trip into AA, but the first drink. You know, and I beg to my father, my heavenly father, to keep me away from that son of a bitch. And to steal a line from Dennis Lee, I think he would take it quite personally if I drank again. I don't know what your story is. I talk too much half the time to hear it anyway. But I know for me, my higher power would take it very personal if I drank. You know, and I love you people. You know, the love is in the people. I don't really believe it's necessarily in the principles. Those things are really hard to obtain, and I'm trying to strive there as best I can. But I believe the real love of Alcoholics Anonymous is in Shalaby and Steve and Dave Legg and Dennis Lee and Steve Brinken and Ike Winchell and Bob Bart. You know, that's where the love is. It's in Doug and Nancy. And if you're new to this group, you need to find out who the fuck those people are. I'll give you a little clue. They're the people that your dry friends are avoiding. Come join us. We do not want to join you. They used to tell us, we don't want what you have. We are trying to get rid of it. Come join us. The water is fine. I remember one year, and I'll shut up. I'll wrap it up a little bit. I was volunteering down at AA's central office. And Ike used to make me go down there because I wasn't working right after Warm Springs. And I hear people complaining about having to show up to a meeting regularly. Tried doing central office for 5.5 hours, hearing nothing but AA, all these AA people, these AA signs, AA lyrics. I mean, it's a brainwashing fucking technique. None of my close friends right now do any volunteer work at AA central office. And I hear them bitching about these little bitty parts of AA that they have to do, primarily a meeting and getting there. And my point is that when he made me do that, now, and my head said he made me do it, it probably was just a subtle command. But nevertheless, I showed up for it, and that experience, I think it changed my sobriety by volunteering down it and watching them answer that phone and listen to these crazy moms and these crazy parents and these crazy alcoholics. And realizing that something more than being okay was happening with these people. And the tool of, you know, sponsorship and all of these little things that keep AA from falling apart, man, is just so readily available for anybody. But the only requirement for membership is this desire. I'm going to pitch a little bit about that and shut up. To me, and this is just my experience, coupled with my opinion, I apologize for those who are allergic to opinion, but my opinion has changed because my experience has changed. So my experience is connected to my opinion. I am a human becoming. I'm unfolding into something. And what I've experienced around here when it comes to AA is a fucking miracle. I have no idea how it's happening. And I don't care. We care. Because we're here to do AA. So if you got other problems, if you got other issues, if you got other fears that don't fit into our step work, there's a plethora of places where you can go. I've had to go to those places because I understood through him and his friends that AA had a singleness of purpose. And it is my responsibility as a person who's been around here for a little while to respect what that singleness of purpose is and to be an example of that in the meetings. And it's not to shun anybody, it's to welcome those who really have alcoholism. Because the front drink is a motherfucker. All these other problems of abundance, there's all these places where I can go. But at my job, when they have these meetings and stuff, and we're talking about the children with autism and whatnot, I'm not allowed to stand up in that meeting and go, excuse me, I know that this conference is about autism, but my Honda is kicking ass, man. AA is about sobriety for me. AA is about being connected to love, and AA is about staying away from that front drink. And if you have a problem with that, we can help you. But you got to be willing to admit that that is the problem. The utter inability to leave it alone. No matter how great the wish, you know, I couldn't stay sober. You know? I love the open door, man. This place, we fought for about 3 months to put air in here. We didn't want the air in here. We thought it would cost us too much money. And then a year, when I came back, they put all this bullshit in here. It was like, fuck, all that fighting for nothing. I remember one time we had an issue about how much coffee we were going to put in the filter. And we had this sort of rival going. We had the 2-scoop people against the 3-scoop people. As our newcomers die, you know. I am a 2-scooper. Sit on the other side of the room, you know. And I don't even drink coffee today. I haven't had a cup of coffee in 10 years. But God damn it, that was important at the time, you know. Being a 2-scooper, I am the chairman of the 2-scooper, you know. You know how we get it, hey man, things become important. Like the door closed or the door open group. How many people want the back door open? Are you with me? You know. And what is the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous? You know, to me, I believe that the American Medical Association, they nail it. They say, don't drink and go to AA. In spite of all the weird stuff that you hear and all the stuff that we see on TV and these people that are like passing out drunk that are popular with their chips hanging out, you know, blowing our anonymity to shit. In spite of all of that, man, God is still keeping us here, man. There are some tangible men and women here that are really doing AA, that have not stepped out of the singleness of purpose for nothing. And those are the people that I'm looking for, man. Those are the people that I want to die sober with. If you're a newcomer, I hope you find something here other than the shit you brought here. I hope you find something in Alcoholics Anonymous. Shalabi is my ex-wife, and I appreciate her taking the time to have me come out, and thanks for letting me share.